Daisy is walking a drum tune. You can almost hear it by looking at the way she walks. She is black, and she knows that white clothes look good on her, so she wears them for dress-up. She's got those big black eyes with plenty shiny white in them that makes them shine like brand new money. And she knows what God gave women eyelashes for, too. Her hair is not what you might call straight. It's Negro hair, but it's got a kind of white flavor, like the piece of string out of a ham. It's not ham at all, but it's been around ham and got the flavor. It was spread down thick and heavy over her shoulders and looked just right under a big white hat. "Lord, Lord, Lord," that same Charlie Jones exclaims, rushing over to Daisy. "It must be a recess in heaven if St. Peter is letting his angels out like this. You got three men already laying at the point of death about you, and here's another fool that's willing to make time on your gang." All the rest of the single men have crowded around Daisy by this time. She is parading and blushing at the same time. "If you know anybody that's about to die about me, you know more than I do," Daisy bridled. "Wished I'd know who it is." "Now, Daisy, you know Jim and Dave and Lum is about to kill one another about you. Don't stand up here and tell that big old got that wrong." "There's a mighty hush mouth about it, if there is. They ain't never told me nothing." You talk too fast. Here Jim and Dave is right up on the porch, and Lum is inside the store." A big burst of laughter at Daisy's discomfiture. The boys had to act out their rivalry, too. Only this time, everybody knew they meant some of it. But all the same, the porch enjoyed the play and helped out whenever extras were needed. David said, "Jim don't love Daisy. He don't love you like I do." Jim bellowed indignantly, "Who don't love Daisy? I know you ain't talking about me." "Well, all right, let's prove this thing right now. We'll prove right now who loved this gal the best. How much time is you willing to make for Daisy?"
20 years.
"See, I told you that nigga don't love you. Me, I'll beg the judge to hang me and wouldn't take nothing less than life." There was a big, long laugh from the porch. Then Jim had to demand a test.
"Dave, how much would you be willing to do for Daisy if she was to turn fool enough to marry you?"
"Me and Daisy done talked that over. But if you just got to know, I'd buy Daisy a passenger train and give it to her."
"Is that all? I'd buy her a steamship, and then I'd hire some men to run it for her."
"Daisy, don't let Jim fool you with his talk. He don't aim for to do nothing for you. A little old steamship? Daisy, I'll take a job cleaning out the Atlantic Ocean for you anytime you say you so desire."
There was a great laugh, and then they hushed to listen.
"Daisy, you know my heart and all the ranges of my mind. And you know if I was riding up in an aeroplane way up in the sky and I looked down and seen you walking and knowed you'd have to walk 10 miles to get home, I'd step backward off of that aeroplane just to walk home with you."
There was one of those big blowout laughs, and Janie was wallowing in it. Then Jody ruined it all for her. Mrs. Bogle came walking down the street towards the porch. Mrs. Bogle, who was many times a grandmother, but had a blushing air of coquetry about her that cloaked her sunken cheeks. You saw a fluttering fan before her face, and magnolia blooms and sleepy lakes under the moonlight when she walked. There was no obvious reason for it. It was just so. Her first husband had been a coachman, but studied jewelry to win her. He had finally become a preacher to hold her till his death. Her second husband worked in Fone's Orange Grove, but tried to preach when he caught her eye.
He never got any further than a class leader, but that was something to offer her. It proved his love and pride. She was a wind on the ocean. She moved men, but the helm determined the port. Now, this night, she mounted the steps, and the men noticed her until she passed inside the door.
"My God, Janie," Stark said impatiently. "Why don't you go on and see what Miss Boker wants? What you waiting on?"
Janie wanted to hear the rest of the play acting and how it ended, but she got up sullenly and went inside. She came back to the porch with her bristles sticking out all over her and with dissatisfaction written all over her face. Joe saw it and lifted his own hackles a bit. Jim Weston had secretly borrowed a dime, and soon he was loudly beseeching Daisy to have a treat on him. Finally, she consented to take a pickled pig foot on him. Janie was getting up a large order when they came in, so Lum waited on them. That is, he went back to the keg, but came back without the pig foot.
"Mr. Stark, the pig feet is all gone," he called out. "Oh, no, they ain't, Lum. I bought a whole new keg of 'em with that last order from Jacksonville. Come in yesterday."
Joe came and helped Lum look, but he couldn't find the new keg either. So he went to the nail over his desk that he used for a file to search for the order.
"Janie, where'd that last bill of lading?"
"It's right there on the nail, ain't it?"
"No, it ain't neither. You ain't put it where I told you to. If you get your mind out the streets and keep it on your business, maybe you could get something straight sometime."
"Oh, look around there, Jody. That bill ain't apt to be gone off nowheres. If it ain't hanging on the nail, it's on your desk. You're bound to find it if you look."
"With you here, I oughtn't have to do all that looking and searching. I done told you time and time again to stick all them papers on that nail. All you got to do is mind me. How come you can't do like I tell you?"
"You sure love to tell me what to do, but I can't tell you nothing, I see."
"That's 'cause you need telling," he rejoined hotly. "It would be pitiful if I didn't. Somebody got to think for women and children and chickens and cows. My God, they sure don't think none of themselves."
"I knows a few things, and women folks think sometimes, too."
"Oh, no, they don't. They just think they're thinking. When I see one thing, I understand 10. You see 10 things and don't understand one."
Times and scenes like that put Janie to thinking about the inside state of her marriage. Time came when she fought back with her tongue as best she could, but it didn't do her any good. It just made Joe do more. He wanted her submission, and he'd keep on fighting until he felt he had it. So gradually, she pressed her teeth together and learned to hush. The spirit of the marriage left the bedroom and took to living in the parlor. It was there to shake hands whenever company came to visit, but it never went back inside the bedroom again. So she put something in there to represent the spirit, like a Virgin Mary image in a church. The bed was no longer a daisy field for her and Joe to play in. It was a place where she went and laid down when she was sleepy and tired. She wasn't petal open anymore with him. She was 24 and 7 years married when she knew. She found that out one day when he slapped her face in the kitchen. It happened over one of those dinners that chasten all women sometimes. They plan and they fix and they do, and then some kitchen-dwelling fiend slips a scorchy, soggy, tasteless mess into their pots and pans. Janie was a good cook, and Joe had looked forward to his dinner as a refuge from other things. So when the bread didn't rise and the fish wasn't quite done at the bone and the rice was scorched, he slapped Janie until she had a ringing sound in her ears and told her about her brains before he stalked on back to the store. Janie stood where he left her for unmeasured time and thought. She stood there until something fell off the shelf inside her. Then she went inside there to see what it was. It was her image of Jody, tumbled down and shattered. But looking at it, she saw that it never was the flesh and blood figure of her dreams, just something she had grabbed up to drape her dreams over. In a way, she turned her back upon the image where it lay and looked further. She had no more blossomy openings dusting pollen over her man, neither any glistening young fruit where the petals used to be. She found that she had a host of thoughts she had never expressed to him, and numerous emotions she had never let Jody know about, things packed up and put away in parts of her heart where he could never find them. She was saving up feelings for some man she had never seen. She had an inside and an outside now, and suddenly she knew how not to mix them. She bathed and put on a fresh dress and head kerchief and went on to the store before Jody had time to send for her. That was a bow to the outside of things. Jody was on the porch, and the porch was full of Eatonville as usual at this time of the day. He was baiting Mrs. Tony Robbins, as he always did when she came to the store. Janie could see Jody watching her out of the corner of his eye while he joked roughly with Mrs. Robbins. He wanted to be friendly with her again. His big, big laugh was as much for her as for the baiting. He was longing for peace, but on his own terms. "Ay, God, Mrs. Robbins, what made you come here and worry me when you see I'm reading my newspaper?" Mayor Starks lowered the paper in pretended annoyance. Mrs. Robbins struck her pity pose and assumed the voice. "'Cause I'm hungry, Mrs. Starks. Deed I is. Me and my children is hungry. Tony don't feed me.' This was what the porch was waiting for. They burst into a laugh. "'Mrs. Robbins, how can you make out you's hungry when Tony comes in here every Saturday and buys groceries like a man? 3 weeks, shame on you!'
"'Well, if you buy all that you're talking about, Mrs. Starks, God knows what he'd do with it. He sure don't bring it home, and me and my poor children are so hungry. Mr. Starks, please give me a little piece of meat for me and my children.'
"'I know you don't need it, but come on inside. You ain't going to let me read till I give it to you.'
Mrs. Tony's ecstasy was divine.
"'Thank you, Mrs. Starks. You's noble. You's the most gentlemanly-fied man I ever did see. You's a king.'
The salt pork box was in the back of the store, and during the walk, Mrs. Tony was so eager, she sometimes stepped on Joe's heels. Sometimes she was a little before him, something like a hungry cat when somebody approaches her pan with meat. Running a little, caressing a little, and all the time making little urging-on cries.
"'Yes, indeed, Mr. Starks. You's noble. You got sympathy for me and my poor children. Tony don't give us nothing to eat, and we're so hungry. Tony don't feed me.'
This brought them to the meat box, and Joe took up the big meat knife and selected a piece of side meat to cut. Mrs. Tony was all but dancing around him.
"'That's right, Mr. Talk. Give me a little piece back this wide,' she indicated as wide as her wrist and hand. "'Me and my children are so hungry.'
Starks hardly looked at her measurements. He had seen them too often. He marked off a piece much smaller and sunk the blade in. Mrs. Tony all but fell to the floor in her agony.
"'Lord of mercy, Mr. Starks, you ain't going to give me that little teeny piece for me and all my children, is you? Lord, we're so hungry.'
Starks cut right on and reached for a piece of wrapping paper. Mrs. Tony leaped away from the proffered cut of meat as if it were a rattlesnake.
"'I wouldn't touch it. That little eye full of bacon for me and all my children? Lord, some folks has got everything, and they're so griping and so mean.'
Starks made as if to throw the meat back in the box and close it. Mrs. Tony swooped like lightning and seized it and started towards the door.
Some folks ain't got no heart in their bosom. They're willing to see a poor woman and her helpless children starve to death. God's going to put them under arrest some of these days with their stingy, griping ways.
She stepped from the store porch and marched off in high dudgeon. Some laughed and some got mad.
"If that was my wife," said Walter Thomas, "I'd kill a cemetery dead.
More special after I done bought her everything my wages can stand, like Tony do," Coker said. "In the first place, I never would spend on no woman what Tony spent on her."
Starks came back and took his seat. He had to stop and add the meat to Tony's account.
"Well, Tony tells me to humor her along. He moved here from up the state hoping to change her, but it ain't. He say he can't bear to leave her and he hate to kill her, so ain't nothing to do but put up with her." "That's 'cause Tony love her too good," said Coker. "I could break her if she was mine. I'd break her or kill her, making a fool out of me in front of everybody."
"Tony won't never hit her," he said. "Beating women is just like stepping on baby chickens. He claims there ain't no place on a woman to hit," Joe Lindsay said with scornful disapproval. "But I'd kill a baby just born this morning for a thing like that. 'Tain't nothing but low-down spitefulness against her husband make her do it."
"That's the God's truth," Jim Stone agreed. "That's the very reason."
Janie did what she had never done before, that is, thrust herself into the conversation. "Sometimes God gets familiar with us women folks, too, and talks his inside business. He told me how surprised he was about y'all turning out so smart after him making you different, and how surprised y'all is going to be if you ever find out you don't know half as much about us as you think you do. It's so easy to make yourself out God Almighty when you ain't got nothing to strain against but women and chickens."
"You's getting too mouthy, Janie," Starks told her. "Go fetch me the checkerboard and the checkers. Sam Watson, use my fish."
The years took all the fight out of Janie's face. For a while, she thought it was gone from her soul. No matter what Jody did, she said nothing. She had learned how to talk some and leave some. She was a rut in the road, plenty of life beneath the surface, but it was kept beaten down by the wheels. Sometimes she stuck out into the future, imagining her life different from what it was. But mostly she lived between her hat and her heels, with her emotional disturbances like shade patterns in the woods, come and gone with the sun. She got nothing from Jody except what money could buy, and she was giving away what she didn't value. Now and again, she thought of a country road at sunup and considered flight. To where? To what? Then, too, she considered 35 is twice 17, and nothing was the same at all. "Maybe he ain't nothing," she cautioned herself. "But he is something in my mouth. He's got to be, else I ain't got nothing to live for. I'll lie and say he is. If I don't, life won't be nothing but a store and a house." She didn't read books, so she didn't know that she was the world and the heavens boiled down to a drop. Man attempting to climb to painless heights from his dunghill. Then one day, she sat and watched the shadow of herself going about tending store and prostrating itself before Jody, while all the time she herself sat under a shady tree with the wind blowing through her hair and her clothes. Somebody near about making summertime out of lonesomeness. This was the first time it happened, but after a while it got so common she ceased to be surprised. It was like a drug. In a way, it was good, because it reconciled her to things. She got so she received all things with the stolidness of the earth, which soaks up urine and perfume with the same indifference. One day, she noticed that Joe didn't sit down. He just stood in front of a chair and fell in it. That made her look at him all over. Joe wasn't so young as he used to be. There was already something dead about him. He didn't rear back in his knees any longer. He squatted over his ankles when he walked. That stillness at the back of his neck, his prosperous-looking belly that used to thrust out so pugnaciously and intimidate folks, sagged like a load suspended from his loins. It didn't seem to be part of him anymore. Eyes a little absent, too. Jody must have noticed it, too. Maybe he had seen it long before Janie did and had been fearing for her to see, because he began to talk about her age all the time, as if he didn't want her to stay young while he grew old. It was always, "You ought to throw something over your shoulder before you go outside. You ain't no young pullet no more. You's an old hen now." One day, he called her off the croquet grounds. "There's something for the young folks, Janie. You out there jumping around and won't be able to get out of bed tomorrow." If he thought to deceive her, he was wrong. For the first time, she could see a man's head naked of its skull, saw the cunning thoughts race in and out through the caves and promontories of his mind, long before they darted out of the tunnel of his mouth. She saw he was hurting inside, so she let it pass without talking. She just measured out a little time for him and set it aside to wait. It got to be terrible in the store. The more his back ached and his muscle dissolved into fat and the fat melted off his bones, the more fractious he became with Janie, especially in the store. The more people in there, the more ridicule he poured over her body to point attention away from his own. So one day, Steve Mixon wanted some chewing tobacco, and Janie cut it wrong. She hated that tobacco knife anyway. It worked very stiff. She fumbled with the thing and cut way away from the mark. Mixon didn't mind. He held it up for a joke to tease Janie a little. "Look here, Brother May, what your wife done took and done." It was cut comical, so everybody laughed at it. A woman and a knife, no kind of knife, don't belong together. There was some more good-natured laughter at the expense of women. Jody didn't laugh. He hurried across the post office side and took the plug of tobacco away from Mixon and cut it again, cut it exactly on the mark, and glared at Janie. "I got a mighty, a woman stay around a store till she get old as Methuselah and still can't cut a little thing like a plug of tobacco. Don't stand there rolling your pop eyes at me with your rump hanging nearly to your knees." A big laugh started off in the store, but people got to thinking and stopped. It was funny if you looked at it right quick, but it got pitiful if you thought about it a while. It was like somebody snatched off part of a woman's clothes while she wasn't looking, and the streets were crowded. Then, too, Janie took the middle of the floor to talk right into Jody's face, and that was something that hadn't been done before. "Stop mixing up my doings with my looks, Jody. When you get through telling me how to cut a plug of tobacco, then you can tell me whether my behind is on straight or not."
What's that you say, Janie? You must be out of your head."
"No, I ain't out of my head neither."
"You must be, talking any such language as that.
You the one started talking under people's clothes, not me."
"What's the matter with you, know how? You ain't no young girl to be getting all insulted about your looks. You ain't no young courtin' gal. You's an old woman, nearly 40.
"Yeah, I'm nearly 40, and you's already 50. How come you can't talk about that sometime, instead of always pointing at me?"
"'Tain't no use you getting all mad, Janie, 'cause I mentioned you ain't no young gal no more. Nobody in here ain't looking for no wife out of you, old as you is."
No, I ain't no young gal no more. But then I ain't no old woman neither. I reckon I looks my age, too. But I'm a woman, every inch of me, and I know it. And that's a whole lot more than you can say. You big bellies round here and put out a lot of brag. But tain't nothing to it but your big voice. Talking about me looking old. When you pull down your britches, you look like the change of life. Great God from Zion, Sam Watson gasped. You're really playing the dozen tonight. Well, what's that you said? Joe challenged, hoping his ears had fooled him. You heard her. You ain't blind, Walter taunted.
I'd rather be shot with tacks than to hear that about myself, Lige Moss commiserated.
Then Joe Starks realized all the meanings, and his vanity bled like a flood. Janie had robbed him of his illusion of irresistible maleness that all men cherish, which was terrible. The thing that Saul's daughter had done to David, but Janie had done worse. She had cast down his empty armor before men, and they had laughed, would keep on laughing. When he paraded his possessions hereafter, they would not consider the two together. They'd look with envy at the things and pity the man that owned them. When he sat in judgment, it would be the same. Good-for-nothings like Dave and Lum and Jim wouldn't change place with him. For what can excuse a man in the eyes of other men for lack of strength? Raggedy behind squirts of 16 and 17 would be giving him their merciless pity out of their eyes while their mouths said something humble. There was nothing to do in life anymore. Ambition was useless, and the cruel deceit of Janie, making all that show of humbleness and scorning him all the time, laughing at him, and now putting the town up to do the same. Joe Starks didn't know the words for all this, but he knew the feeling. So he struck Janie with all his might and drove her from the store. After that night, Jody moved his things and slept in a room downstairs. He didn't really hate Janie, but he wanted her to think so. He had crawled off to lick his wounds. They didn't talk too much around the store, either. Anybody that didn't know would have thought that things had blown over. It looked so quiet and peaceful around. But the stillness was the sleep of swords. So new thoughts had to be thought, and new words said. She didn't want to live like that. Why must Joe be so mad with her for making him look small when he did it to her all the time? Had been doing it for years. Well, if she must eat out of a long-handled spoon, she must. Jody might get over his mad spell any time at all and begin to act like somebody towards her. Then, too, she noticed how baggy Joe was getting all over, like bags hanging from an ironing board. A little sack hung from the corners of his eyes and rested on his cheekbones. A loose-filled bag of feathers hung from his ears and rested on his neck beneath his chin. A sack of flabby something hung from his loins and rested on his thighs when he sat down. But even these things were running down like candle grease as time moved on. He made new alliances, too. People he never bothered with one way or another now seemed to have his ear. He had always been scornful of root doctors and all their kind, but now she saw a faker from over around Altamont Springs hanging around the place almost daily, always talking in low tones when she came near or hushed altogether.
She didn't know that he was driven by a desperate hope to appear the old-time body in her sight. She was sorry about the root doctor because she feared that Joe was depending on the scoundrel to make him well when what he needed was a doctor and a good one. She was worried about his not eating his meals till she found out he was having old Lady Davis to cook for him. She knew that she was a much better cook than the old woman and cleaner about the kitchen, so she bought a beef bone and made him some soup. "No, thank you," he told her shortly. "I'm having a hard enough time to try and get well as it is." She was stunned at first and hurt afterwards, so she went straight to her bosom friend, Phoebe Watson, and told her about it. "I'd rather be dead than for Jody to think I'd hurt him," she sobbed to Phoebe. "It ain't always been too pleasant, 'cause you know how Joe worshipped the works of his own hands. But God in heaven knows I wouldn't do one thing to hurt nobody. It's too underhand and mean."
"Janie, I thought maybe the thing would die down and you never would know nothing about it, but it's been singing round here ever since the big fuss in the store that Joe was fixed and you was the one that did it."
"Phoebe, for the longest time, I've been feeling that something's set for stillbait. But this is, oh, Phoebe, what can I do?
You can't do nothing but make out you don't know. It's too late for y'all to be splitting up and getting divorced. Just go on back home and sit down on your raw diasticus and say nothing. Nobody won't believe it nohow.
To think I've been with Jody 20 years and I just now got to bear the name of poisoning him. It's about to kill me, Phoebe. Sorrow, dog by sorrow, is in my heart.
That's lie, that trashy nigger that calls himself a two-headed doctor brought to him in order to get in with Jody. He seen he was sick. Everybody been knowing that for the last longest. And then I reckon he heard y'all was kind of at variance, so that was his chance. Last summer, that multiplied cockroach was around here trying to sell gophers."
"Phoebe, I don't even believe Jody believed that lie. He ain't never took no stock in the mess. He just make out he'd believe it to hurt me. I'm stone dead from standing still and trying to smile." She cried often in the weeks that followed. Joe got too weak to look after things and took to his bed, but he relentlessly refused to admit her to his sick room. People came and went in the house. This one and that one came into her house with covered plates of broth and other sick room dishes without taking the least notice of her as Joe's wife. People who never had known what it was to enter the gate of the mayor's yard, unless it were to do some menial job, now paraded in and out as his confidants. They came to the store and ostentatiously looked over whatever she was doing and went back to report to him at the house. Said things like, "Mr. Starks needs somebody to sort of look out for him till he can get on his feet again and look for himself." But Jody was never to get on his feet again. Janie had Sam Watson to bring her the news from the sick room, and when he told her how things were, she had him bring a doctor from Orlando without giving Joe a chance to refuse and without saying she sent for him.
"Just a matter of time," the doctor told her. "When a man's kidneys stop working altogether, there's no way for him to live. He needed medical attention 2 years ago. Too late now."
So Janie began to think of death. Death, that strange being with the huge square toes who lived way in the west. The great one who lived in the straight house like a platform without sides to it and without a roof. What need has death for a cover? And what winds can blow against him? He stands in his high house that overlooks the world, stands watchful and motionless all day with his sword drawn back, waiting for the messenger to bid him come. been standing there before there was a where or a when or a then. She was liable to find a feather from his wings lying in her yard any day now. She was sad and afraid, too. Poor Jody. He ought not to have to wrestle in there by himself. She sent Sam in to suggest a visit, but Jody said no. These medical doctors was all right with the godly sick, but they didn't know a thing about a case like his. He'd be all right just as soon as the two-headed man found what had been buried against him. He wasn't going to die at all. That was what he thought. But Sam told her different, so she knew. And then if he hadn't, the next morning she was bound to know, for people began to gather in the big yard under the palm and chinaberry trees. People who would not have dared to foot the place before crept in and did not come to the house, just squatted under the trees and waited. Rumor that wingless bird had shadowed over the town. She got up that morning with a firm determination to go on in there and have a good talk with Jody. But she sat a long time with the walls creeping in on her, four walls squeezing her breath out. Fear lest he depart while she sat trembling upstairs nerved her, and she was inside the room before she caught her breath. She didn't make the cheerful, casual start that she had thought out. Something stood like an oxen's foot on her tongue. And then, too, Joe, gave her a ferocious look, a look with all the unthinkable coldness of outer space. She must talk to a man who was 10 immensities away. He was lying on his side, facing the door, like he was expecting somebody or something, a sort of changing look on his face, weak-looking but sharp-pointed about the eyes. Through the thin counterpane, she could see what was left of his belly huddled before him on the bed, like some helpless thing seeking shelter. The half-washed bedclothes hurt her pride for Jody. He had always been so clean.
What you doing in here, Janie?
Come to see about you and how you was making out. He gave a deep growling sound, like a hog dying down in the swamp and trying to drive off disturbance.
I come in here to get shit of you, but look like they ain't doing me no good. Gone out. I needs to rest.
No, Jody, I come in here to talk with you, and I'm going to do it, too. It's for both our sakes I'm talking. He gave another ground rumble and eased over on his back. Jody, maybe I ain't been such a good wife to you, but Jody,
that's 'cause you ain't got the right feeling for nobody. You ought to have some sympathy about yourself. You ain't no hog.
But Jody, I meant to be awful nice.
Much as I done for you, holding me up to scorn. No sympathy.
No, Jody, it wasn't because I didn't have no sympathy. I had a lavish of that. I just didn't ever get no chance to use none of it.
You wouldn't let me. That's right. Blame everything on me. I wouldn't let you show no feeling. And Janie, that's all I ever wanted or desired. Now you come blaming me.
Tain't that, Jody. I ain't here to blame nobody. I'm just trying to make you know what kind of person I is before it's too late.
Too late, he whispered.
His eyes buckled in a vacant-mouthed terror, and she saw the awful surprise in his face and answered it.
Yeah, Jody, don't care what that multiplier
cockroach told you to get your money. You got to die, and you can't live. A deep sob came out of Jody's weak frame. It was like beating a bass drum in a hen house. Then it rose high, like pulling in a trombone. Janie, don't tell me I got to die. And I ain't used to thinking about it. Tain't really no need of you dying, Jody, if you had the doctor. But it don't do no good bringing that up now. That's just what I wants to say, Jody. You wouldn't listen. You done lived with me for 20 years, and you don't half know me at all. And you could have, but you were so busy worshiping the workers of your own hands and cuffing folks around in their minds till you didn't see a whole heap of things you could have. Leave here, Jenny. Don't come here. I knowed you wasn't going to listen to me. You changes everything, but nothing don't change you, not even death. But I ain't going out of here, and I ain't going to hush. Now you're going to listen to me one time before you die. Have your way all your life, tramp and mash down, and then die rather than let yourself hear about it. Listen, Jody. You ain't the Jody I run off down the road with. Use what's left after he died. I run off to keep house with you in a wonderful way. But you wasn't satisfied with me the way I was. No. My own mind had to be squeezed and crowded out to make room for yours in me. Shut up! I wish thunder and lightning would kill you. I know it. And now you got to die to find out that you got to pacify somebody besides yourself if you want any love and any sympathy in this world. You ain't tried to pacify nobody but yourself. You're too busy listening to your own big voice. All this tearing down to talk. Jody whispered with sweat globules foaming all over his face and arms. Get out of here. All this bowing down, all this obedience under your voice. That ain't what I rushed off down the road to find out about you. A sound of strife in Jody's throat, but his eyes stared unwillingly into a corner of the room. So Janie knew the futile fight was not with her. The icy sword of the square-toed one had cut off his breath and left his hands in a pose of agonizing protest. Janie gave them peace on his breast. Then she studied his dead face for a long time. Just sitting in the ruling chair has been hard on Jody. She muttered out loud. She was full of pity for the first time in years. Jody had been hard on her and others, but life had mishandled him too. Poor Joe. Maybe if she had known some other way to try, she might have made his face different. But what that other way could be, she had no idea. She thought back and forth about what had happened in the making of a voice out of a man, then thought about herself. Years ago, she had told her girl self to wait for her in the looking glass. It had been a long time since she had remembered. Perhaps she'd better look. She went over to the dresser and looked hard at her skin and features. The young girl was gone, but a handsome woman had taken her place. She tore off the kerchief from her head and let down her plentiful hair. The weight, the length, the glory was there. She took careful stock of herself, then combed her hair and tied it back up again. Then she starched and ironed her face, forming it into just what people wanted to see, and opened up the window and cried, "Come here, people! Jody is dead! My husband is gone from me!" Jody's funeral was the finest thing Orange County had ever seen with Negro eyes. The motor hearse, the Cadillac and Buick carriages, Dr. Henderson there in his Lincoln, the hosts from far and wide, then again the gold and red and purple, the gloat and glamour of the secret orders, each with its insinuations of power and glory undreamed of by the uninitiated. People on farm horses and mules, babies riding astride of brothers and sisters' backs, the Elks band ranked at the church door and playing Safe in the Arms of Jesus with such a dominant drum rhythm that it could be stepped off smartly by the long line as it filed inside. The little emperor of the crossroads was leaving Orange County as he had come, with the outstretched hand of power. Janie starched and ironed her face and came set in the funeral behind her veil. It was like a wall of stone and steel. The funeral was going on outside. All things concerning death and burial were said and done. Finish, end, nevermore, darkness, deep hole, disillusion, eternity, weeping and wailing outside. Inside the expensive black folds were resurrection and life. She did not reach outside for anything, nor did the things of death reach inside to disturb her calm. She sent her face to Joe's funeral, and herself went rollicking with the springtime across the world. After a while, the people finished their celebration, and Janie went on home. Before she slept that night, she burnt up every one of her head rags and went about the house next morning with her hair in one thick braid swinging well below her waist. That was the only change people saw in her. She kept the store in the same way, except of evenings. She sat on the porch and listened and sent Hezekiah in to wait on late custom. She saw no reason to rush at changing things around. She would have the rest of her life to do as she pleased. Most of the day she was at the store, but at night she was there in the big house, and sometimes it creaked and cried all night under the weight of lonesomeness. Then she'd lie awake in bed, asking lonesomeness some questions. She asked if she wanted to leave and go back where she had come from and try to find her mother, maybe tend her grandmother's grave, sort of look over the old stamping ground generally. Digging around inside of herself like that, she found that she had no interest in that seldom-seen mother at all. She hated her grandmother and had hidden it from herself all these years under a cloak of pity. She had been getting ready for her great journey to the horizons in search of people. It was important to all the world that she should find them and they find her. But she had been whipped like a cur dog and run off down a back road after things. It was all according to the way you see things. Some people could look at a mud puddle and see an ocean with ships, but Nanny belonged to that other kind that loved to deal in scraps. Here, Nanny had taken the biggest thing God ever made, the horizon. For no matter how far a person can go, the horizon is still way beyond you. And pinched it in to such a little bit of a thing that she could tie it about her granddaughter's neck tight enough to choke her. She hated the old woman who had twisted her so in the name of love. Most humans didn't love one another nohow, and this mislove was so strong that even common blood couldn't overcome it all the time. She had found a jewel down inside herself, and she had wanted to walk where people could see her and gleam it around. But she had been set in the marketplace to sell, been set for stillbait. When God had made the man, he made him out of stuff that sung all the time and glittered all over. Then after that, some angels got jealous and chopped him into millions of pieces. But still he glittered and hummed, So they beat him down to nothing but sparks. But each little spark had a shine and a song. So they covered each one over with mud. And the lonesomeness in the sparks made them hunt for one another. But the mud is deaf and dumb. Like all the other tumbling mud balls, Janie had tried to show her shine. Janie found out very soon that her widowhood and property was a great challenge in South Florida. Before Jody had been dead a month, she noticed how often men who had never been intimates of Joe drove considerable distances to ask after her welfare and offer their services as advisor. A woman by herself is a pitiful thing, she was told over and over. They needs aid and assistance. God never meant 'em to try to stand by theirselves. You ain't been used to knocking round and doing for yourself, Miss Starks. You've been well taken care of. You needs a man. Janie laughed at all these well wishes because she knew that they knew plenty of women alone, that she was not the first one they had ever seen, but most of the others were poor. Besides, she liked being lonesome for a change. This freedom feeling was fine. These men didn't represent a thing she wanted to know about. She had already experienced them through Logan and Joe. She felt like slapping some of them for sitting around grinning at her like a pack of Chessie cats, trying to make out they looked like love. Ike Green sat on her case seriously one evening on the store porch when he was lucky enough to catch her alone. "You wants to be careful about who you marry, Miss Starks. These strange men running around here trying to take advantage of your condition." "Marry?" Janie almost screamed. "Joe ain't had time to get cold yet. I ain't even give marrying the first thought." "But you will. You's too young a woman to stay single, and you's too pretty for the men's to leave you alone. You's bound to marry."
"I hope not. I mean, at this present time, it don't come before me. Joe ain't been dead 2 months. Ain't got settled down in his grave."
"That's what you say now, but 2 months more and you'll sing another tune. Then you want to be careful. Women folks is easy taking advantage of. You know what to let none of these stray niggas that sit around here get the inside track on you. They're just like a pack of hogs when they see a full trough. What you needs is a man that you done lived around and know all about to sort of manage the things for you and generally do round."
Janie jumped upon her feet.
"Lord, I Green, use a case. This subject you bringing up ain't fit to be talked about at all. Let me go inside and help Hezekiah whip that barrel of sugar to just come in."
She rushed on inside the store and whispered to Hezekiah, "I'm going to the house. Let me know when that old Peter bed is gone, and I'll be right back." 6 months of wearing black passed, and not one suitor had ever gained the house porch. Janie talked and laughed in the store at times, but never seemed to want to go further. She was happy, except for the store. She knew by her head that she was absolute owner, but it always seemed to her that she was still clerking for Joe, and that soon he would come in and find something wrong that she had done. She almost apologized to the tenants the first time she collected the rents. Felt like a usurper. But she hid that feeling by sending Hezekiah, who was the best imitation of Joe that his 17 years could make. He had even taken to smoking and smoking cigars since Joe's death, and tried to bite him tight in one side of his mouth like Joe. Every chance he got, he was reared back in Joe's swivel chair, trying to thrust out his lean belly into a paunch. She'd laugh quietly at his no harm posing and pretend she didn't see it. One day, as she came in the back door of the store, she heard him bawling at Trip Crawford.
"No, indeed, we can't do nothing of the kind. Hi, God, you ain't paid for them last rations you done ate up. Hi, God, you won't get no more out of this store than you got money to pay for. Hi, God, this ain't Gimme, Florida. This is Edenville."
Another time, she overheard him using Joe's favorite expression for pointing out the differences between himself and the careless-living, mouthy town. "I'm an educated man. I keep my arrangements in my hands." She laughed outright at that. His acting didn't hurt nobody, and she wouldn't know what to do without him. He sensed that and came to treat her like baby sister, as if to say, "You poor little thing, give it to Big Brother. He'll fix it for you." His sense of ownership made him honest, too, except for an occasional jawbreaker or a pack of sin-sin. The sin-sin was to let on to the other boys and the pullet-sized girls that he had a lick of breath to cover. This business of managing stores and women's store owners was trying on a man's nerves. He needed a drink of liquor now and then to keep up. When Janie emerged into her morning white, she had hosts of admirers in and out of town. Everything open and frank. Men of property, too, among the crowd. But nobody seemed to get any further than the store. She was always too busy to take them to the house to entertain. They were all so respectful and stiff with her that she might have been the Empress of Japan. They felt that it was not fitting to mention desire to the widow of Joseph Starks. You spoke of honor and respect. And all that they said and did was refracted by her inattention and shot off towards the rim bones of nothing. She and Phoebe Watson visited back and forth and once in a while sat around the lakes and fished. She was just basking in freedom for the most part, without the need for thought. A Sanford undertaker was pressing his cause through Phoebe, and Janie was listening pleasantly but undisturbed. It might be nice to marry him at that. No hurry. Such things take time to think about. Or rather, she pretended to Phoebe that that was what she was doing. "'Tain't that I worries over Joe's death, Phoebe. I just love this freedom." "Shh. Don't let nobody hear you say that, Janie. Folks will say you ain't sorry he's gone." "Let 'em say what they wants to, Phoebe. To my thinking, mourning oughtn't to last no longer than grief." One day, Hezekiah asked off from work to go off with the ball team. Janie told him not to hurry back. She could close up the store herself this once. He cautioned her about the catches on the windows and doors and swaggered off to Winter Park. Business was dull all day because numbers of people had gone to the game. She decided to close early because it was hardly worth the trouble of keeping open on an afternoon like this. She had set 6 o'clock as her limit. At 5:30, a tall man came into the place. Janie was leaning on the counter making aimless pencil marks on a piece of wrapping paper. She knew she didn't know his name, but he looked familiar. "Good evening, Miss Starks," he said with a sly grin, as if they had a good joke together. She was in favor of the story that was making him laugh before she even heard it. "Good evening," she answered pleasantly. "You got all the advantage 'cause I don't know your name. People wouldn't know me like they would you. I guess standing in a store do make a person get to be known in the vicinity. Look like I seen you somewhere." "Oh, I don't live no further than Orlando. I'm easy to see on Church Street most any day or night. You got any smoking tobacco?" She opened the glass case.
"What kind?"
"Camels." She handed over the cigarettes and took the money. He broke the pack and thrust one between his full purple lips. "You got a little piece of fire over there, lady?" They both laughed, and she handed him 2 kitchen matches out of a box for that purpose. It was time for him to go, but he didn't. He leaned on the counter with one elbow and cold-cocked her a look. "Why ain't you at the ball game, too? Everybody else is there."
"Well, I see somebody else besides me ain't there. I just sold some cigarettes."
They laughed again.
That's 'cause I'm dumb. I got the thing all mixed up. I thought the game was going to be out at Hungerford, so I got a ride to where this road turns off from the Dixie Highway and walked over here, and then I find out the game is in Winter Park. That was funny to both of them, too.
So, what you gonna do now? All the cars in Eatonville is gone.
How about playing you some checkers? You looks hard to beat.
I is, 'cause I can't play a lick.
You don't cherish the game, then?
Yes, I do.
And then again, I don't know whether I do or not, 'cause nobody ain't never showed me how. This the last day for that excuse. You got a board round here?
Yes, indeed. The men folks treasures the game round here. I just ain't never learned how.
He set it up and began to show her, and she found herself glowing inside. Somebody wanted her to play. Somebody thought it natural for her to play. That was even nice. She looked him over and got little thrills from every one of his good points. Those full, lazy eyes with the lashes curling sharply away like drawn scimitars. The lean, over-padded shoulders and narrow waist. Even nice.
He was jumping her king, she screamed in protest against losing the king she had had such a hard time acquiring. Before she knew it, she had grabbed his hand to stop him, and he struggled gallantly to free himself. That is, he struggled, but not hard enough to wrench a lady's fingers.
I got a right to take it. You left it right in my way.
Yeah, but I was looking off when you went and stuck your man right up next to mine. No fair.
You ain't supposed to look off, Miss Starks. It's the biggest part of the game to watch out. Leave go my hand.
No, sir, not my king. You can take another one, but not that one.
They scrambled and upset the board and laughed at that.
Anyhow, it's time for a Coca-Cola, he said. I'll come teach you some more another time.
It's all right to come teach me, but don't come to cheat me.
You can't beat a woman. They just won't stand for it. But I'll come teach you again. You're going to be a good player, too, after a while.
You reckon so? Jody used to tell me I never would learn. It was too heavy for my brains.
Folks is playing it with sense, and folks is playing it without. But you got good meat on your head. You'll learn. Have a cool drink on me.
Oh, all right, thank you.
Got plenty of cold ones today. Nobody ain't been here to buy none. All gone off to the game.
You ought to be at the next game. Tain't no use in you staying here if everybody else is gone. You don't buy from yourself, do you?
You crazy thing. Of course I don't.
But I'm worried about you a little.
How come? Afraid I ain't gonna pay for these drinks?
Oh, no. How you going to get back home?
Wait round here for a car. If none don't come, I got good shoe leather. 'Tain't but 7 miles nohow. I could walk that in no time, easy.
If it was me, I'd wait on the train. 7 miles is a kind of long walk.
It would be for you, 'cause you ain't used to it. But I'm seeing women walk further than that. You could, too, if you had it to do.
Maybe so, but I'll ride the train long as I got railroad fare.
I don't need no pocket full of money to ride the train like a woman. When I takes a notion, I ride anyhow, money or no money.
Now, ain't you something? You never did tell me what your name was.
I sure didn't. Wasn't expecting for it to be needed. The name my mama gave me is Virgible Woods. They calls me Tea Cake for short.
Tea Cake? So you sweet as all that?
She laughed, and he gave her a little cut-eye look to get her meaning. I may be guilty. You better try me and see.
She did something halfway between a laugh and a frown, and he set his hat on straight.
Believe I done cut a hog, so I guess I better catch air.
He made an elaborate act of tipping to the door stealthily. then looked back at her with an irresistible grin on his face. Janie burst out laughing in spite of herself. You crazy thing! He turned and threw his hat at her feet. If she don't throw it at me, I'll take a chance on coming back, he announced, making gestures to indicate he was hidden behind a post. She picked up the hat and threw it after him with a laugh. Even if she had a brick, she couldn't hurt you with it, he said to an invisible companion. The lady can't throw. He gestured to his companion, stepped out from behind the imaginary lamppost, set his coat and hat, and strolled back to where Janie was, as if he had just come in the store. Evening, Miss Starks. Could you let me have a pound of knuckle pudding till Saturday? I'm sure to pay you then. You needs 10 pounds, Mr. Teacake. I'll let you have all I got, and you needn't bother about paying it back. They joked and went on till the people began to come in. Then he took a seat and made talk and laughter with the rest until closing time. When everyone else had left, he said, I reckon I done overlaid my leaving time, but I figured you needed somebody to help you shut up the place. Since nobody else ain't around here, maybe I can get the job. Thank you, Mr. Teacake. It's kind of straining for me. Who ever heard of a tea cake being called Mister? If you want to be real high tone and call me Mr. Woods, that's the way you feel about it. If you want to be a little friendly and call me tea cake, that would be real nice. He was closing and bolting windows all the time he talked. All right, then. Thank you, tea cake. How's that? Just like a little girl with her Easter dress on. Even nice. He locked the door and shook it to be sure and handed her the key. Come on now, I'll see you inside your door and get on down to Dixie. Janie was halfway down the palm-lined walk before she had a thought for her safety. Maybe this strange man was up to something. But it was no place to show her fear there in the darkness between the house and the store. He had hold of her arm, too. Then in a moment, it was gone. Tea cake wasn't strange. Seemed as if she had known him all her life. Look how she had been able to talk with him right off. He tipped his hat at the door and was off with the briefest good night. So she sat on the porch and watched the moon rise. Soon its amber fluid was drenching the earth and quenching the thirst of the day.